This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The Republican leader of the Assembly is held in contempt of court for failing to produce records related to his review of the 2020 election. We'll tell you the financial toll it could have on taxpayers. Plus, ahead of the April 5th election, some clerks and voters are confused about a court order regarding absentee voting. And a COVID-19 critic and strong supporter of decertifying the 2020 election enters the attorney general race. We'll discuss why she's running. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 1st.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
I'm Patrick Marley.
Patrick, thanks so much for being on the show this week.
Thank you.
We got a lot to cover. We're going to start with probably the biggest headline of the week is that a Dane County judge found Assembly Speaker Robin Voss held in contempt of court for him failing to produce open record request that the liberal watchdog group American Oversight sued to get documents, mm-hmm. which are related to this ongoing election investigation being led by Michael Gableman. So Judge Valerie Bailey Rinn held Speaker Voss in contempt of court, like I said, for failing to produce those records. And Voss and the Assembly will basically have to turn over these documents from the GOP order election investigation within 14 days and pay a $1,000 fine if they fail to do so. So Speaker Voss was actually, I guess, caught after a meeting by a Racine Journal Times reporter. And he's basically defending that this is a liberal judge just trying to punish him and that they don't want to seek the truth about this election investigation. And he basically says, well, I don't think I violated any laws, and I think it's very difficult to locate deleted emails. So let's first take a listen to Speaker Voss, sure. and then we'll get into the weeds of this.
When you have deleted emails, how do you get deleted emails back if they're from Gmail? We already have an expert saying they can't be done. We have followed the law. There's no problem with what we're doing. It's really them trying to stop our investigation. This all focuses back on them not wanting to get to the truth of what happened in 2020. So it's unfortunate that rather than following the law, she's chosen to take the law into her own hands, and that's what I think is happening here. You can't produce emails that you don't have, and she somehow believes that we do. We don't.
So the judge also ordered Voss to pay American Oversight's legal fees. So he could possibly have to pay these fines. But I guess the big question is, Patrick, are taxpayers going to be on the hook to pay for this bill?
It seems almost certain that the taxpayers will pay for it. I mean, typically, if you're a state employee and you do something that you say you think is within the lines of your job duties, you know, he says he was trying to comply with the open records law. He didn't accomplish that, according to the judge. But since that's part of his duties, that would typically be paid by taxpayers. Now, it may get dicey if it gets to the point where these fines are actually levied. You know, if he resolves this in the next 14 days and gives them the records, then he has to pay these legal bills. But there would be a fine if it actually ends up being $2,000 a day, because both Voss and the Assembly are subject to them, and it adds on every day. So there could be a lot of political pressure on him if that's the case. You know, we have seen cases. Dale Coinga at one time was lost a court case, and it was $30,000 that had to be paid, and that was originally going to be paid by taxpayers. He faced a lot of backlash for that and ended up paying it himself.
Right, because, I mean, in a sense, I guess Voss can say, oh, I'll take care of this, or maybe make Gableman pay for it, but, you know,
right.
Why, right? I mean, why? I guess we really don't know. And also, I think what's important here, too, is that it kind of raises questions is why are these records deleted and what was maybe possibly in them? Or was it just, oh, I don't think this is important, you know, put it in the trash?
Right. So it's an interesting quirk of state law that, you know, if you're in the executive branch, you have to retain your records and you have to produce them when people make open records requests. If you're in the legislature, you have to produce records that people ask for, but you have no obligation to retain them. And so they were deleting some records. Now, they did have open records requests. This judge has found that they were supposed to prevent these records from being deleted and produce them. And now the judge has said, you've got to go further and you've got to find ways to recover the records. So that's one of the things he has to do is find the records that were lost and then turn them over.
And then if not, he has to give an explanation
yes,
to the judge
yes,
as well. And I think it's also important to note, this is kind of American Oversight's second legal victory in a row, because there's
yes.
three lawsuits that they filed. It was a few weeks ago. I think it was the beginning of March, I want to say.
Yep.
They won in another lawsuit that opened, you know, probably over, it was over 700 pages of Michael Gableman's documents related to his investigation that didn't really show much of a review, but kind of gave us some details about what he's been spending his money on and just how slow of a start his investigation really got to happen once it was originally launched. He was buying office furniture and all this other stuff. So I guess we still have one other case, too, with American Oversight that will still remains to be seen what happens in that.
And you have
one.
To wonder, I mean, there could be more that comes, because even the 700 pages that were produced, there were a lot of sort of, you know, records that we didn't get that you would have expected to see. Gableman was supposed to be writing weekly reports. No one's ever produced that, so either he wasn't writing them or they've held those back. A lot of the records, like, you know, you'd see a 3-page email, but you'd only get the first page of it. And so I would not be surprised if somebody goes back to court to say Gableman hasn't really produced everything he's supposed to produce in that case.
And that just leaves this question open, too, of when will this investigation end? Are we ever going to, you know, get more details about it? And at least we're getting some snippets here and there. But
yeah, I mean, it's going to go on for months more. It appears there was a hearing recently where the judge... a judge in a different case set a hearing for July. So this is going to continue to stretch on and on.
And I one other thing before we move on to the next topic, too, is we just don't know how much taxpayer budget Gableman has left over. He was given $676,000.
Yes.
I think the last time American Oversight tracked it was close to $500,000, but no one really knows. Is that pot of money still there? Is there going to be another contract with more money to pay legal fees? It's just so many still questions.
And also, Voss hasn't said that he's technically increased that budget, but he said the state will cover all legal bills affiliated with this. And so to go past that $676,000 seems quite likely.
Right. Next, I want to touch on the April 5th election, because that is coming up on Tuesday. And I talked to a lot of clerks, and I know you have too, as well as voters, Patrick, that there's still just so much confusion after a court ruling basically made changes to how people can vote absentee.
Right.
So the new rules surrounding absentee ballot drop boxes and who can return them has just a lot of people a little all over the place. What do I do? So this comes after a state Supreme Court ruled that ballots can only be returned by mail at the clerk's office and only by the voter themselves. So I couldn't take your ballot and return it on your behalf. Now, the state's high court is expected to, you know, deal with this ballot drop box for future elections down the road. But I kind of just want to talk. I know both of us have kind of interviewed people, especially voters with disabilities, who are just very confused. They're calling their clerk saying, well, I can't drive to my polling place.
Right.
I'm afraid to put it in the mail or someone else put it in the mail for me, because technically there's just this gray area, because the state is silent on Dropbox, and then we have this court ruling. So it's I guess, what have you heard from some people who are really worried about this?
I talked to a number of disabled people who are in situations where they just don't see how they can get their ballot back. They can't go to the polls because of their disability, so they order absentee ballots. They're able to do that. They receive the absentee ballot. You know, someone who's a quadriplegic doesn't have use of their hands. They can get assistance to fill out the ballot, but then there doesn't seem to be a way between the court rulings and the way the law is written for that to get in the mail, because this person can't physically put it into the mailbox himself. How is he supposed to get it there if the court has been so clear that you have to do it yourself? So these are the kinds of things that the state Supreme Court is really going to have to examine. You know, the rules are a little unclear here for April. I've also talked to clerks, and they're frustrated because they feel like they're caught between these different rulings and set of policies. So the state Supreme Court has a lot to sort of iron out in the weeks ahead as we think about the fall elections.
And depending on what clerk you talk to, I kind of experienced they're kind of doing their own way, in a sense. I know I talked to Milwaukee and Madison. They say as long as you are returning someone's ballot and you got permission to do so, they'll still take it. But I talked to the clerk in Whitefish Bay, and she said, well, if there's people showing up with two ballots, we're unfortunately turning them away.
Right.
Let's just take a listen to her. I interviewed her earlier in this week of kind of the frustrations that she's expressing and the ever-changing election rules, because she first started in 2020, so she's been through a lot so far. So let's take a listen.
I don't know that it created more confusion. I do agree that it kind of was a be careful with what you're doing. But I think for us, that just really made us say, okay, drop boxes shut down and only individual voters can bring back their ballots. We didn't really want to get into any gray area of, oh, can someone bring back a ballot for someone else, or, you know, that sort of thing. So we just kind of went full with the rules. And it's hard because sometimes these changes are immediately right before an election, and just trying to get it out as quick as you can. I think one big thing is just, and I think people here are very understanding of that, we aren't the ones making the rules. Unfortunately, we just have to enforce them.
So one of the last things that she just stated too is that, you know, most voters understand that she's not the one making the rules, mm-hmm. even though some people can show up and be like, what do you mean?
Right.
When did this change?
Right?
I wasn't aware of this. And I'm sure there's some people that get frustrated because they didn't know this was different. Because in the past, as we know, many people used these relied on these ballot drop boxes and the way that they used to do things during the pandemic.
And Wisconsin is such a quirky place because we have about 1,850 clerks, and they all do get to run their own show.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the community next door might have slightly different rules than you, different early voting hours, for instance. And that can, some it gives local officials a lot of autonomy, but it can create some confusion for people because the policies aren't consistent from one place to the next.
Right. And in Milwaukee, of course, such a big city, mm-hmm. they're offering, again, this weekend, a drive-up, drop-off ballot collection where people don't have to leave their vehicle. They can hand it off to a trained poll worker who's then going to put it in a drop box. But this, you know, the clerk, this Milwaukee City clerk is basically saying, you know, well, we think this is legal because they're staffed. They're not unmanned drop boxes.
And the court decision does just speak to unstaffed ballot drop boxes.
Correct.
So, you know, but it can get hard for a voter because they hear ballot boxes can't be used, and then they see the staffed ones used in Milwaukee, and they say, you know, what's
I've had
going
to do
on?
A lot of explainer stories, I'll tell you
absolutely.
That, for my viewers in Milwaukee. One last thing I do want to note on this topic is that the League of Municipalities did send a memo to clerks in hopes to try to help them, guide them during these ever-changing mm-hmm. rules. And they, in a sense, kind of warned them, be careful how you're dealing with certain scenarios, especially with voters with disabilities. And the memo kind of states that clerks that refuse to accept absentee ballots delivered by third parties on behalf of a disabled elector may face possible litigation.
Yes.
So that's almost, in a sense, just, you know, don't refuse someone's ballot. But then again, they're
clerks
trying
are in
to
this tight spot because if the example you gave of somebody coming back with two ballots,
mm-hmm.
if they accept them both, they face the potential of litigation from the right. You know, Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty initiated mm-hmm. this lawsuit. And if this person were to say, like, I'm bringing it for a disabled spouse, and they said no to that, then, you know, Disability Rights Wisconsin or another advocate for the disabled could sue them. So, you know, this case is before the state Supreme Court now, but I don't think we've heard the last of it. It's very possible we could see future litigation over these issues.
Absolutely. Next thing I want to touch on briefly is just what else will be on the ballot is a lot of school referendums. The Wisconsin Association of School Board tracked this data that you're seeing right here on this slide that said there'll be 81 questions that will be on the April 5th ballot. 35 of those questions will be to issue debt. 8 are to exceed revenue limits on a recurring basis, 38 to exceed revenue basis on a non-recurring basis. This basically, Patrick, comes as a lot of school districts are having to, once again, go ask voters to help pay for school-related costs. And a lot of these districts are just dealing with declining enrollment, and they're facing erosion over the time and on their spending authority. So this is kind of a trend we've tracked for a while.
It's been going on for a long time. Yeah. I mean, for more than a decade, the legislature's put very tight controls on what schools can spend. And so, you know, they're only sort of safety valve if they don't have enough money. I mean, they could cut spending, which is hard to do if you have growing costs. But you can go to voters in these referendums. So we've just seen these happen over and over again where mm-hmm. where people are so
more people
agreeing to pay higher taxes for schools.
Right. And then the next topic I want to bring up is kind of Kevin Nicholson, mm-hmm. the GOP candidate for governor. He has some endorsement woes is kind of how I titled this. Patrick, this was a story that you broke this week that he is kind of sending mixed messages, I would say, whether or not he wants the party's endorsement. He has all along talked about how he's an outsider and that he wants to have this non-endorsement option at the state party convention in May. But after a month of him really touting that, he told... after saying he didn't want it, Nicholson asked party officials on Tuesday to let the convention delegates consider him as one of the candidates on the ballot. And that was according to your report. So kind of very change of pace, but his campaign is still defending that he still wants a non-endorsement option.
So I mean, not only does he say he wants a non-endorsement option, he says he doesn't want endorsements to happen. He cut this video for Facebook, said he had just been contacted by the party about endorsements, and he said, I don't want the party's endorsement. I don't think the party should endorse. And, you know, his whole campaign has been running against the Republican Party, which he has called a failed machine, and he wants to sort of turn it upside down. And so for all this month, he's been saying no to this. But then he turns up at this party event and says, please make sure you include my name on the ballots so that people can consider me, and also this no endorsement policy. Now, I think the greater goal here is to prevent Rebecca Clayfish from getting the endorsement. Mm-hmm. You need 60% of the votes at the convention to get the endorsement. You know, if voters have two options, just Clayfish or Tim Ramthin, she's got a pretty good shot at getting 60%. If it's also a no endorsement option and Kevin Nicholson, then it's a lot harder for her to get to 60%. So I think that a lot of that is what's at work here.
Right, and I know you have been tracking, and I've been tracking too, talking to a lot of the 72 counties. Mm-hmm. Where our numbers were very close. I think you had 20 counties that voted during their kind of, it's not a convention, annual caucus that they do, and they voted on resolutions that they want a non-endorsement option. Mm-hmm. So it kind of just remains to be seen how many more counties do that. I think most of these caucuses have wrapped up by now. But it's also with the growing trend, too, of those same different counties voting to, want Voss to resign. So we're seeing these two very big in resolutions that are going on that we haven't seen before that are really gaining momentum because we've talked on the show a lot that – you know, the Republican Party claims they're united, but they really are a little all over the place right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, and there's definitely this strain of the base in the Republican Party that doesn't like this idea of endorsements, doesn't trust the party as an institution, and doesn't want to see that happen. So there's a lot of momentum on the Republican side in this cycle, but there's a lot of internal divisions, absolutely.
Right.
And you see that with the Speaker of the Assembly, arguably the most powerful Republican in state government, is under constant attack from the right.
And it's supposed to be Republicans' year, right? You know, they have all this energy going into this year. It's, you know, historically that way because of, you know, who's in the White House and who's control of the House and the Senate. And so we'll see what happens. They still have a lot of time, right?
They do. Yes.
We're not in August yet, but we're in the spring, even though it just snowed this week.
Unbelievably.
You know, they still got time, basically. Speaking about the governor's race, Patrick, another big development, I guess, would you say, is former Governor Tommy Thompson met with President Trump at Mar-a-Lago.
Yes.
This comes after Clayfish also met with Trump. Now, we're not sure if Tommy wants to run. He's leaving a lot of people on the fence, if he will. He's a spry 80 is what he told me, so he doesn't know what he wants to do next. But I think a lot of the same sources that people talk to say it wasn't necessarily Thompson going there saying, I want your endorsement. It's more, let's talk about the future of Wisconsin politics. And, you know, we don't know what was said, but I think, you know, what else?
And it may be that he didn't come and explicitly say, I want your endorsement.
Right.
But, I mean, to be hanging in the air.
Yeah.
I mean, the president knows, the former president knows that Tommy Thompson's looking at a run for governor again. And, you know, from what I can tell, Tommy Thompson is on the fence on this. He doesn't know what he's going to do. He says he's going to decide in April. Really, he has to decide in April because the clock is ticking. But it would really shake up the race if he decided to get in.
And we know how powerful a Trump endorsement would be. I think right now the most likable person that Trump likes would be Representative Ramtham because he is the only one that is strongly pushing for decertification, which you and I both know that legal experts, nonpartisan attorneys have told us is not possible at this point. So it kind of remains to be seen and who will get his attention the most, or will he not endorse?
Right. And obviously a very important issue to Trump is this whole notion of decertification. He's praised Ramtham. Clayfish and Nicholson have taken this, you know, have not gone so far as to support decertification, but have really pushed hard against the election rules we've had and raised concerns about how 2020 was run. We haven't heard from Tommy Thompson on any of that stuff. And obviously, if he gets in the race, it's going to be one of the first questions that he has to deal with.
He did get a question on it the last media call he did on one of his last days as UW system interim president, and he really danced around it. So right. I don't want to get into politics. I asked him the governor question again.
Yeah.
So I think he wanted to just finish his time at UW, and then maybe he'll get badgered by us reporters on how he feels about
it
that.
It will be hard to avoid once he's a candidate.
Right,
if he is a candidate,
because this is a, you know, decertification and election reform are a very important to a lot of Republicans.
Absolutely.
So we'll see what happens. And other this week, the Journal Sentinel also had a story of breaking news about a new Republican candidate entering the attorney general's race. Now, Karen Mueller is a Chippewa Falls attorney, and she's entering the kind of the growing list of Republicans that will join Fond du Lac attorney Eric Tooney and former state rep Adam Jarko. Now, Mueller has an interesting, I guess, background and kind of campaign platform. She has supported efforts to overturn the 2020 election, and she told a reporter or at the Journal Sentinel that she wants to run to investigate six Wisconsin hospitals for their doctors' decisions to not administer Ivermectin.
Ivermectin, sorry guys,
to COVID-19 patients. Now, in a quote, she says, "I'm in running because of potential homicides in hospitals because of vaccines," quote unquote, so-called vaccines. So this is kind of another interesting candidate who, I guess, is kind of a COVID critic, kind of aligns with a lot of similar things that we've heard from U.S. Senator Ron Johnson and his claims about this drug and that vaccines, you know, don't work or they can put people in the hospital or people are dying from them. So kind of just an interesting candidate going into the mix.
Well, so, I mean, first of all, what she's saying is well outside the medical mainstream,
right?
And then even if that were not the case, you know, there are very strong liability protections for doctors and hospitals. The idea that you could charge a doctor with a crime, good luck with that. I mean, it's extremely, the bar is extremely hard. And in fact, they have one specifically for COVID that they passed at the beginning of the pandemic because there was this recognition from government officials that, you know, this is this emerging pandemic. We didn't really know how it was going to be. And so this idea that, like, we want doctors to treat people to the best that they can. And then if it comes out, if there was a medication that they were administering that didn't work, that they couldn't have been held liable. So, you know, these kinds of prosecutions she's talking about would be very hard to actually get through. But she taps into a strain of the Republican Party that has been really skeptical of the way America's reacted to COVID.
Right. And you kind of mentioned, too, the medical side, too. The University of Wisconsin-Madison Preventive Medicine Residency Program Director, quite a title, Dr. Remington, kind of disputed what Mueller was talking about, saying, you know, basically there's clinical trials out there that did not show that this drug lowers the rate of being administered to the hospital due to a progression of COVID-19. So it's definitely something that we'll keep our eye on, and just kind of another candidate into the kind of crowded field already.
Makes it
an interesting race for sure. Last topic I want to talk about is a new federal study that Wisconsin Republican congressional delegation is all backing right now that basically track how judges set bail across the country. As you and I know, Patrick, the bail reform debate has been heightened ever since the Waukesha Christmas Parade tragedy, where suspect Daryl Brooks plowed through and killed six people and injured dozens more. So to kind of highlight what this would do, the bill would require the U.S. Department of Justice to study how courts across the country impose bail and release conditions on suspects charged with violent offenses. Now, the proposal comes as state lawmakers have proposed a host of bail reform measures that we've seen in the past but have been reintroduced, including a constitutional amendment that would make it more difficult for violent offenders to get out on bail. Let's hear from Congressman Scott Fitzgerald, who's touting, of course, this is his legislation, and then Representative Jody Emerson, who was at a legislative day for a group of criminal justice reform advocates, saying why she didn't vote for the constitutional amendment. Let's take a listen.
What we thought we would first try and tackle is to get kind of the nationwide data of how often is this happening, where is it happening, under what type of legal systems is this happening on a regular basis, and then once that information is gathered, be able to modify to show that these are the places that, you know, are recognizably not doing what needs to be done. You could have a lenient DA, you could have a lenient judge, you could have a system that says we're bursting at the seams, we need to release some criminals. What we're trying to do is come up with policy decisions that can be rolled into a number of other bills that that we will be able to tackle, hopefully, short term, to try and wrap our arms around the issue.
I don't think that any of us in this room would argue with the fact that our bail system needs to be reformed. My biggest problem is that I think that some people, some of my colleagues, are taking advantage of a very public, very horrific crime that happened a few months ago, and wanting to focus on it and fix the issue because of what happened at a parade. We all, as Wisconsinites, grieve for the community of Waukesha because of what happened. But I don't believe that this will fix it.
So we know the topic of bail reform is going to be huge, I think, in this upcoming election and addressing the violent uptick in violent crime as well. But it's important to note that there was bail reform measures that passed this year, with some Democrats actually in support of them. But the specific constitutional amendment that would give judges more discretion when setting bail, especially how a suspect would be dangerous, how dangerous they would be if they reenter the community, that takes two consecutive sessions to pass. Right. So while it did pass this year, it still has to pass another time before it goes to voters to ultimately decide.
Right. So they could do that in early 2023, and it doesn't matter who the governor is. The Republicans are going to control the legislature, and they'd be able to advance that. Then it would go to voters, and if they timed it right, they could put it on the same ballot as the state Supreme Court race in 2023. Republicans may view that as giving them an edge in, the Supreme Court race is technically nonpartisan, but all the parties are very, very interested in it.
Yeah, they're definitely using it. And, the governor has kind of been a little silent on what he wants to do with bail reform. He's kind of dodged some questions in the past. You have Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, who's for eliminating the cash bail system. So a lot of people are just on a lot of different wavelengths, I guess you can say, on what they believe is the solution. But it gets tricky because, say as eliminating cash bail, that in a sense can benefit the rich who can afford a high set of bail. But then low-income people, guilty or innocent, they can't pay that. And then they're stuck waiting behind bars before they go to trial. So no one really knows what the perfect solution is, but we know for sure it will be something that lawmakers debate for quite some time.
Absolutely.
All right, Patrick, thank you so much for joining me this week.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Thanks,
that will do it. I'm Emily Fannin.
I'm Patrick Marley.
Thanks for joining us.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.